Steve Train. What? Jump on the Steve Train. We real estate disruptors.
Hey, everybody. Thank you for joining us for today's episode of Real Estate Disruptors. Today, we got my good buddy Will Dennis here, Willie Numbers. And he flew in from Fort Lauderdale, Florida to talk about how he's flipped over $75 million worth of real estate in his entire career. Now, I am on a mission to create 100 millionaires. The information on this podcast alone is enough to help you become a millionaire. In the next 5 to 7 years, if you'll take consistent action, you will become one. Now, we recognize running a sales team is hard work, even thankless at times. You've got to hold your people accountable to what they said they want. This might make you feel exasperated. If you feel like you're alone, I promise you, you're not. Ren and I, we're helping other business owners get through to their sales team to yield record performance, even in this shifting market. If this sounds like it might help you, text LEADERS to 33777. And the show is brought to you by our sister company, Investor Lift. Get access to over 2 million cash buyers across the country. Go to investorlift.com and put in disruptors to get 10% off. If you get value today, please tag a friend below. Share this episode right now. That way we can all grow together. It's a live show, so please ask your questions for Will to answer. You ready?
Ready.
All right. So first question is, what was life like right before you got into real estate?
I had just been fired from my job. I was a corporate America guy, so I literally just got fired.
What was the job?
I was a commodities analyst.
Commodities analyst.
I was a junior trader.
That sounds pretty, I know that's a crazy business, but like that title just sounds like really, bland.
Yeah, it's big.
Right?
Yeah.
So what did you do?
I was on a hedge fund in New York.
See, the hedge funds, it's a little bit more glamorous.
Yeah, it's a little more glamorizing. So mm-hmm. I was on an internal hedge fund at Merrill Lynch that traded oil. So we would hedge a lot of bets within the whole trades floor. I got an internship there, and then I got hired, and I was there for about a year. So I was on my way to become a real trader. I was a junior trader at one point, and I was margining a lot of, you know, big banks. It was institutional. So we would margin Citibank and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I will say that at that time and during that tenure, one thing I took away was I was 24 and I did a margin call to Citibank, and I margin called them over $100 million. And within like 4 hours, the wire hit, and I saw the wire hit. And I just remember how mind blown I was. And the first thing that went through my head, I was like, God, there's so much money out there.
A lot of money out there.
And God, I'm so broke. I was making like 78 grand a year living in New York, which is like negative 50 in reality. So that kind of stuck with me. So when I did get fired, I didn't know that I was going to go into real estate. It wasn't my first choice. It's not even what I studied. I have a background in finance. But I stumbled upon a podcast, which was actually Sean Terry's at the time.
So before you get into that right? So, so you said your background. So you went to college for this.
Yes.
You have a degree in
finance.
Yeah. So went to college, got a job, dream job.
Yeah, I was on Wall Street.
So on the way to my dream job.
Yeah, yeah. It was like my dream that I wanted.
Yeah. And so you're talking about, you know, seeing $100 million wire. So like for me, in my part of my real estate journey was I was working with, you know, all these different ways in real estate. But one of them was selling properties to hedge funds. And so Blackstone was a pretty big fund.
Big boy.
And so they sent over this proof of funds. Like, hey, we want to buy your property. They're like, okay, like, what do you got? I was like, let me see the proof of funds, right? Comes over, it's like $86 million. It's like, okay.
Yeah.
Same thing, like, crap, I'm poor. Okay, so you talk about you got fired. Before we talk about Sean Terry, let's talk about what got you fired.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I was young, obviously, dumb. And, you know, my whole life I've watched Wall Street. It was a passion of mine. It was a goal. It was an ambition. And when I got there, you know, you always see the movies and this and that, and, you know, Wall Street where, you know, streets are paved with gold and this and that. And you really could hustle your way if you work hard. In New York, an average week for me was 100 hours a week. That was no problem. You know, I slept on, you know, beneath my desk. That was standard for that world. Yeah. I mean, it really is. You sleep in your office, especially when you're starting out. I mean, they treat you like shit. And so it's expected.
Like, so it's just like boiler room.
It's just, a little bit. That's more of like a sales room. And that was, you know, that was a little pump and dump. But yeah, it really,
treat you like you are the bottom.
Yeah. Yeah.
You deserve to be at the bottom until you prove yourself.
Yeah. And it's more, you know, Merrill Lynch is a great company. It's not like they go out of their way, you know, like to violate HR or anything like that. But it's more like a rite of passage. And the guys that are 20, 30 years senior, they've been through that. They've been through worse. So I guess it would be like the military, so to speak, right? Where like you got to eat shit for a while until you graduate. But yeah, you start seeing people bail out real quick. So I was always talking to my boss. His name was Jay, and I won't say his last name. But I was always talking to him, and I was trying to push. And I was like, hey, this is what I want to do. Hey, could I do more? Hey, could I, you know, I am right now with my own business, but in
you're
the corporate
trying
world.
to push the envelope.
Yeah. And, you know, 24-year-old punk kid, you know, I didn't have a beard, nothing at the time, so I probably seemed very annoying. So it got to the point where one day he told me in a conversation, he's like, listen, I understand what you're trying to do, but you really need to stay in your lane. And that irked the shit out of me. And I just kept pushing. And one day he told me, he's like, look, either I'm going to fire you or you just stop, fall in line. This is it. Just ride the wave, you know, until otherwise. And I told him, I won't say what I said, but I said some nice, not nice words, and I got fired. So that was
so
that.
You did not stay in your lane.
I did not stay in my lane. I veered off the lane. So yeah, that happened.
All right. So then you happened upon Sean Terry's podcast. So when, like, what year was this exactly?
So I got fired in late 2015, maybe early 2016, if I remember correctly. At that time, I had a friend who, because I moved back in with my mom. So now this is like a depressing stage of my
life.
Back
in Florida?
Back in Florida.
Okay.
So now I'm back home with my mom. She's an immigrant. She's looking at me like, what the hell are you doing? You can't live here for free. And I didn't
come. This is not why we came to America.
Yeah, this is not why we came here. You better get your shit together.
Yeah.
So anyway, and I had a friend who was buying and selling diabetic testing strips. And I know this is going to sound a little out of left field, but at the time I told him, I was like, hey, I'll put up the bandit signs. And I didn't know anything about bandit signs, but I would literally go out in the middle of the night. I'd put up these bandit signs and I'd take the calls in the morning with my business partner at the time. And as I was doing this, I would listen to podcasts. And one time I remember Sean Terry's, I think it was Flip to Freedom was the podcast. And I heard a guy in Miami that was on an interview that he had flipped like a bunch of real estate. He was like 2 years younger than me at the time. So I heard the podcast like three times. And he left his office number there. So I cold called his office. I lied to his secretary. And when I got him on the phone, I told him, I was like, look, you don't know me. I don't know you. Just please don't hang up. If you teach me what you know about this business, I'll split my first five deals with you 50-50. And there's kind of a moment of silence. And he said, can you come in tomorrow at 11? And I was there. And that was that. I bankrolled everything off of credit cards. And that was that.
So, you know, you talk about bandit signs for diabetic strips.
Yeah,
I see these signs periodically.
Yeah.
Is there really money in diabetic strips?
Yeah, so look, the best thing I can say is it was a season in my life, and it's a gray area. But yes, you can make
it. I fully recognize the gray area. There's no question it's a gray area.
It's a gray area.
Right?
Yeah.
Is it actually like worth, if you weren't in real estate, is it actually worth the time?
No. Now it's not, obviously, because I've made other kinds of money in real estate. But it was enough to make me, you know, some weeks, 700, a grand, right? Where a guy that got fired and is unemployed is making $1,000 a week. It was pretty cool. And I was running my own schedule. I was doing my own thing. I would literally just collect them. I would pick them up and I would sell them on eBay at a markup.
So tell me about, you. If you teach me everything you know, I'll split the first five deals with you.
Yeah.
So what did you learn?
So he taught me how to make a list. Right, what wholesaling was, what real estate was, to do it, you know, creatively. And he taught me how to make lists. He taught me how to speak to sellers. You know, he showed me the AB contract that he used, just little things like that.
Yeah.
I bankrolled it off of my credit cards. I started with direct mail, which, by the way, anyone who's watching, not a good way to start unless you have money.
Yeah.
So
it's good. Just don't start.
Don't start there. Yeah. I wouldn't start there. It's like starting with probate leads. Yeah. I wouldn't start there. Yeah. It's going to be a longer grind. But I did that. And, you know, he would be on calls with me and stuff like that. Little things that I would learn, what to say at appointments, how to disposition them. He had the buyer's list. I had nothing. So I think it was 91 days and we did our first five deals. So I was hustling, you know, from the very get-go. I wasn't lollygagging because once I saw the first check hit, which was, I don't know, might have been $6,500, but it was like all the money in the world to me at the time.
Right.
Because I had done it. It was my own thing. And I knew like, oh shit, if I could do this, and this is part-time and I don't know what the hell I'm doing. I was just in New York a couple months ago. Like this can scale.
Sure.
Yeah.
So your first one was from direct mail?
It was from direct mail. The first five were direct mail.
All right, first five were direct mail.
Yeah.
And you did those first five deals with him.
Yeah.
Okay. What were the challenges on those first five deals?
So the first deal I ever got under contract, it was 10748 North Saratoga Drive. I still remember the address. So that first deal actually ended up, the seller backed out. Mm-hmm. And so I get this contract. I'm all excited. It was a good spread. It was like a 30K pop at the time. And the seller decides to call me and say, hey, I'm not selling. And he hangs up the phone. So I didn't know anything about a list pendants or specific performance or anything like that. And he didn't want to pursue that. I don't think he really knew how to do that at the time. So it took a year, and that was my first deal. Mm-hmm. And then I ended up closing on it a year later, mm-hmm. and I actually flipped it myself.
Why? How did you close it a year later?
I raised private money, and I closed on it, and I fixed and flipped it. And that was my first flip ever.
But the guy didn't want to sell, so what did you do to get
it
back?
We ended up suing him.
Got it.
We ended up suing for a specific performance, mm-hmm. and then he came back. I think we increased the price by like 10K, mm-hmm. and we still made a good deal.
On your very first deal, you did a list pendants, sue for specific performance. I mean, that's got to be a little discouraging.
To say the least. Yeah.
Right? Like, I mean, I guess like real quick, because there's two things here we talked about. So for everyone that's listening, let's first explain what a list pendants is. And after that, let's talk about specific performance. So you want to elaborate what those are?
Yeah. So a list pendants or an LP is a lawsuit that you're going to file against a property owner. So banks do it from a lender side when somebody goes into pre-foreclosure or delinquency. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty much a cloud on title that allow, and it's attached to a lawsuit, and you can force what you want to enforce. Mm-hmm. Where in this case, there was a contract signed. I had equitable interest in the contract, right, in the house, and I'm enforcing the sale because now they're trying to back out.
You're letting the public know that there is a pending lawsuit on this property.
Correct.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. So then no one can record a deed on this property.
Yep.
Right. Okay. In a specific performance.
Or that seller can't take out a loan. They can't do anything like that. Right. They can't refi. They can't do anything.
Yeah.
So in other words, you are first position. Mm-hmm. If there's a bank, you're probably second position, but you are first position in line. So if another investor was to come along or something like that, or they were to sell it with a realtor, you're first in line.
Yep.
So it's a cloud on title.
Sure.
Yeah.
And then specific performance.
Specific performance is suing to enforce what you agreed upon in a contract. Mm-hmm. So you said you were going to sell at 200 grand, let's say. Mm-hmm. Now you're backing out and you don't want to sell. Now I'm going to sue you for specific performance, which the performance would be to sell to me.
Yeah. So who coached you through that?
Dude, honestly, I didn't get really any coaching. I remember calling a lot of attorneys. I didn't have my title attorney like I do today.
Yeah.
I met him a few months after that, actually, ironically. But, again, just resourcefulness. I started calling around title companies. I started speaking to attorneys. I knew a couple guys at some RIA meetings that were seasoned investors and, you know, kind of coupled all that information.
So
and,
you had a community of sorts that kind of walk you through it. Yep. So, again, got to be a little discouraging, like the first deal, right? Because like there's this roller coaster, right? And for everyone, like when you do a deal, whether it's your first deal, your 50, whatever, bad things happen.
Yeah.
Right? And in those bad things, you're like, man, I can't believe this is real. I'm going to get paid. And then what?
Yeah.
Right? And it's a gut punch.
Yeah, it is.
So talk to me about like, you know, the adversity you face, especially since this was your very first deal.
Yeah. So, you know, the natural thoughts come out, which is this real? Now you start questioning everything. Mm-hmm. Maybe real estate is bullshit. Maybe you can't do this. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's not meant for me. Maybe I don't deserve this, right? All those thoughts ran through my head. But I knew even when I started, and it's just my natural personality, I said, well, if it's not on the first one, then I'm just going to go stack up some more. So that was my mentality. And I made a decision when I got fired where it was, I literally told my mom, I was like, I am never working for anybody else again. And I remember saying that very verbatim. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I stuck to it. So I didn't want to quit. And, you know, I kind of, it sucked at the time, but I took it almost like a challenge. I was like, all right, well, not every deal is going to be like, that was my mentality. I was like, well, not everyone's going to back out.
Right.
And they didn't, you know, and it ended up clearing out. And I think my second deal was a few weeks after that. And that one closed. It was pretty smooth per se. And then the third one was, you know, some liens on it. The fourth one had some violations. So that was a whole nother learning experience. Mm-hmm. And yeah, just kept going through there.
Okay. So you said, you know, first five deals, we're going to do 50-50.
Mm-hmm.
After that, do you continue working with them or did you like go off to your own thing?
So I did. I think I did like another three deals, but it was more he co-wholesaled them because I didn't have a buyer's list still at the time. So I would bring them to him and he would kind of have like first right of refusal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was like a flat fee. It was like $3,000 or something, and he brought a buyer. And then after that, at that point, I was just off to the races.
And when your business, when did it become a real business?
I would say 2.5 years into it is mm-hmm. when I think I had joined the super group and all that. Mm-hmm. And the first time that I was ever in that room with those guys. And I still to this day don't know how I ended up in that room, but I'm glad I did. But yeah, just seeing how people ran things mm-hmm. and not treating it as a hobby. So yeah. I got pretty serious and intentional. Mm-hmm. Like KPIs started coming out, you know, things like that where yeah. you start to track your marketing. And I was intentional about it.
Yeah. So Supergroup, let's talk about Supergroup real quick.
Yeah.
What is Supergroup?
Let's start secret there. Society.
What is Supergroup? It was a secret society. Yeah. So let's start it. What is Supergroup?
Yeah. So Supergroup is a mastermind that mm-hmm. we're both a part of, actually. Yeah. You came in like a little after me, but we've both been in there for a long time.
Yeah.
So it's a group of guys that were in other masterminds, mm-hmm. excluding myself because I was never in a mastermind before Supergroup. So, yeah. But it's a group of guys that kind of got a little tired of the other masterminds. Mm-hmm. And they were like, hey, we're going to make this private group. Mm-hmm. And we won't charge ridiculous fees and all these dues. We'll just pay enough to make the events happen and we'll mm-hmm. travel and we'll be in non-competing markets.
Yeah.
When I came in, that's kind of how it was.
Right.
It still is that way.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a like a private, I would say it's a private mastermind.
Yeah.
Per se.
So the super group, right? Because I remember like Donald Ross. Yeah. Right? So I just signed up for Beast Mode CRM. I was like, you know, this thing's like the coolest thing. And he's like, yeah, you know, this you know, I built this out because you got a bunch of people in Supergroup asking for this, for that. So I just made it. Like, okay, hang on. What's Supergroup?
Yeah, tell me about that.
Right? It's like, oh, you know, we got Scott Ouse, Joe Taylor, and, you know, some of these other guys. And like, yeah. Wait a minute. So you guys all just hang out.
Yeah.
And you guys just share what's working in you guys' business. How do I get in? He's like, oh, you're locked out. So what do you mean I'm locked out? I said, you're in Phoenix. You're locked out. I was like, okay, well, that sucks.
Yeah.
Right? I had to wait and bide my time until a seat vacated. But yeah, Supergroup is such a great group because we got a good community of guys there that are truly go-givers mm-hmm. and are actually helping each other.
Yeah.
All right, so when did your brother get into your operation?
So he's my half-brother, but yeah, so we started together in the operation. So he had graduated from Notre Dame, and I was fired from Merrill Lynch. He played football. His career was over. So when I heard the podcast, I stormed into his room one day, and I told him, I was like, we're getting into real
Younger
estate.
Brother?
Yeah, and I was like, we're getting into real estate. Be ready tomorrow at 8 a.m. Yeah. And he was playing Madden, I think. And he just looked at me like, okay. And I just shut the door and I ran out. So, and that was like, you know, the day after I cold called this guy.
Yeah, so if only recruiting was so easy.
If only recruiting, yeah. But again, you know, dude, look, I'm the type of person that when I want something or mm-hmm. when I want to go get something, it's latched on. It's a dog with a bone. Mm-hmm. I don't care. Whoever's coming is coming. Whoever's not, it's not. I'm going.
Right.
So that was the intention, and I think I still carry myself that way now. It's just a little bit different, a little bit more poise, I would say.
Well, but you learned some things along the way.
Yeah, just a little bit.
Yeah. So what were some of the struggles then, you know, like along your journey? Like as you were growing it, what were some of the biggest struggles you faced along the way?
Delayed gratification is one thing that I'm 31 now. So when I started, I was 25. Mm. You know, when you start making a little bit of money and you start having some success, you kind of try to, you count that, you add extra weight to that and you feel like it's never going to stop. So you feel like, oh man, I made 40 grand this month. Mm-hmm. No problem. I'll go get this car. I'll go buy a stupid watch, whatever it is. Right. And not that there's anything wrong with those kinds of things, but I've learned the biggest lesson is that there's a time and place. Mm-hmm. Don't get overzealous ahead of time, because I know some people that in the last 2 years, for example, that I've gotten into this business and things, let's not kid ourselves, things were skyrocketing. Mm-hmm. Everybody and their mother can make money.
With easy money.
Yeah. So it created like a fallacy mm-hmm. of how good you were or how successful you actually were and how much you're making because it was so inflated.
A little bit of overconfidence.
Right. And now they're in trouble. Mm-hmm. Right. I see it across the board. And, you know, even myself, I scaled out my operation in the last year and a half to a size that was wow, right? Mm-hmm. It was $7 million a year. It was great. But that also came with 120 grand a month overhead. Mm-hmm. While the market is great, that's awesome. No problem. When you're having 500K months, no issue. Mm-hmm. Now, when the market decides to take a shit and the Fed starts to raise rates aggressively, you got a problem. Mm-hmm. And that's not an easy stop. That's like a big train mm-hmm. that you have to slow it down. It takes like a mile to finally stop. Right. And it hits anything in the way. So that's one of the best lessons I've learned. And it's just making, another thing that I've learned over the last 6 years, I wish from the beginning I would have thought a lot bigger. That's definitely something that I have the confidence and now I am thinking bigger. Mm-hmm. But I think that when you're first starting out, you don't have a lot of self-confidence. You might have enough belief or self-belief to start, mm-hmm. which is great, but you think smaller because you think that that's where you belong. Mm-hmm. And I wish I would have just thought a lot bigger. You know, maybe some commercial deals, multifamily. Even though I did some, but I did the math backwards, mm-hmm. I wish I would have put more intention on it.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Oh, it makes total sense. So what are some of your biggest wins along the way? We just talked about, you know, some of the challenges. What are some of the biggest wins along the way?
Financial or what? Or just in general? Dude, I helped a lot of people create serious financial freedom. Mm-hmm. You know, I've probably single-handedly changed a lot of neighborhoods, which is pretty cool to drive around them. A lot of people have come through my organization over the years. They've learned a lot, you know, their words, not mine. I've been able to be around a lot of cool people like yourself and all that. The relationships is great. The money is also, you know, of course, incredible.
For sure.
But it's more proving to myself. The biggest win I've had is proving to myself that you can set out and do something and you can go a lot further than what you actually think you can.
How does it feel saying that after getting fired?
Yeah. It's pretty cool. I wish I ran into the guy today. Honestly, I would just say thank you. And he probably wouldn't even know who the hell I am. But yeah. I would just say you have no idea who I am, but I appreciate it.
So then I guess, you know, talking about like realizing this, right? Like mm-hmm. there's a point where you realize real estate could be real, mm-hmm. right? Might've been very, 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 very beginning. What was that feeling like when you realized real estate could be real?
That feeling was when I got my first check mm-hmm. or wire. Actually, no, it was a check. And I deposited it and it was $6,500, I think. Mm-hmm. It was more than I was making working 100 hours a week at Merrill Lynch in New York. So, and at this time, I'm living at home with my mom. So yeah. At that point, and then the second one hit, the third one hit, the fourth, and the fifth, probably within a month and a half from each other.
Yeah.
So it was the most money I had ever seen ever in my life. And that was proof of concept for me. That was literally everything I needed because all in all, in a 91-day time span, that's really not a long time. So to go from not knowing anything to, hey, I just made 30 grand in a month, that's pretty freaking cool. So that just forced me to drive harder.
Sure.
Because I saw it was possible.
So then let's talk about, you know, you've done 75 million in transactions in your career.
Yeah.
But, you know, let's talk about someone where to build out their business to look like what yours looks like today.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the things I'll have to do to build a business that looks like, you know, Willie numbers?
So be careful how fast you scale. Mm-hmm. Less is more. I learned that the hard way.
Yeah.
The answer is not always, hey, let's throw more money at marketing. That was my answer, and I think a lot of guys in the supergroup too.
It is an answer.
It's an answer, but I don't think you're going to like the response that you're going to get, especially not in an economy like what we're in today. The last 2 years, I couldn't throw enough money at marketing. Honestly, I should have thrown a lot more, and I thought I was throwing a lot with 100K a month.
Yeah.
But yeah, be careful how you scale. Make sure that one thing I did with Sharper and Gary and all that – awesome. I know you've done it as well.
Gary Harper's an amazing individual and they've got an amazing organization. Yeah,
super plug to Sharper right there. But really, it's document and systemize your business as you're going through it. It's much easier to do when you're a one man or a two man band or women because everything's so small. So there's less processes, there's less everything.
Right. We're in the same room. Hey, Willie, did you talk to that guy yet?
Yeah. Just document simple things like, hey, how did I go back for that reduction? All right, well, this is what didn't work. Well, this is what worked. Okay, cool. So let's design a system around that. Hey, the house is vacant. Okay, cool. What did we do? Well, we put a lockbox. Okay, cool. How did we do that? Well, let's write that down. Mm-hmm. You know, and if this, then that, right? Those kinds of things. So I wish I would have documented my journey sooner rather than later because as you start to scale and now you got a team of 5, 10, 15, it's like, oh, shit, now I got to go back and backtrack because if you don't create a process, your employees will create one and you won't really like it most of the time. So, you know, that's why McDonald's is so successful.
Right.
Because there's two 16-year-old punk kids that can run a McDonald's because everything's documented and everything's systemized.
Can't screw it up.
No. So that's definitely something I would be careful how you scale.
Mm-hmm.
I also wouldn't be afraid to dream and I wouldn't be afraid to invest in marketing and make sure that you go deep before you decide to go wide.
Right. So what does your organization look like today? What is the, you know, all the people inside your company?
So we went from an organization of about 20, I think at the top end, including VAs and everything, probably 25. Our organization today is probably like 11. Mm-hmm. We're a lot leaner, obviously, with the economic times.
Yeah.
We went from 120K a month to probably spending 40, 30, give or take on the month. We're, long story short, we're a lot leaner. Mm-hmm. We're going deeper. We focus more on the sales process, and it's more creative. Sure. Meaning it's not so much cash offers everywhere, running around with a hammer and selling everything as a cash sale, right? Mm-hmm. I think you need to learn novations. You need to be good with subject twos. You need to be a little bit more creative in order to fulfill the needs of that seller.
Yeah.
And in this economy, it's clear as day.
Yeah. So let's talk about this. So
120K
a month to 40K a month.
Yeah.
Pretty big.
It happened over a period of 5 months.
Right.
It didn't happen overnight.
It didn't happen overnight.
No.
But like, for me, June 15th was a big day. Same for you?
Yeah.
All right. So talk to me about this journey, right? Because, you know, we talk a lot, like you've done some substantial numbers. Mm-hmm. Really impressive.
Thank you.
To now downshift.
Yeah.
Must have been a little painful.
It is painful. Yeah, for sure.
So let's talk about what was the process in downshifting? I know it's not as exciting as a topic, but
no, it's not
a real
conversation. But it's an important topic. Yeah. And I think for a lot of people out there, they need to hear it because I think one fallacy that people see is, you know, I did a lot of numbers and I transacted a lot, but they don't really talk. A lot of people don't really talk about, well, this is what I look like today. Mm-hmm. Right. And are vulnerable about it because it's not always that way.
Right.
So it was painful. It's hard to see 15 to 20 transactions a month go down to 7 to 10, mm-hmm. right? Which is still respectable, in my opinion. It's still 100 deals a year, which is a pretty high ticket or high volume organization. But you learn a lot through that. So one of the things that I learned as I was scaling down, which no one teaches you how to scale down, they only teach you how to scale up. Mm-hmm. So that's a topic right there.
Yeah.
So as you're scaling down, because it was the first economic shift that a lot of us had experienced since 2017, all I've ever seen is this. When did you get in?
2007.
Okay. So yeah,
I got to cut my teeth in a difficult market.
That was a tough one, right? Yeah. You hit the airbag right at the beginning.
Yeah.
So I didn't, mm-hmm. right? So I remember in 2017, people were telling me, oh dude, this market's so saturated. Prices are so high. That was in 2017. Look at where we are today. Yeah. I wish I could buy everything at the prices I was buying in 2017 and 2018. So as you scaled down, you start to notice mistakes and cracks. Mm-hmm. And what do I mean by that? So I did all the numbers. We did over 150 transactions, give or take, in that year. And when I look back, after everything started to slow down, you know, you start to let go of some people, the noise kind of dissipates. Mm-hmm. And I looked at all the cancellations and everything that didn't move. And I did an inventory of it over the last 12 months. And what I found was an extra $2 million in revenue that somebody else converted, either another wholesaler, because we didn't follow up. We didn't have the processes to do so because we were such a high volume activity. Mm-hmm. So what you learn is how to dial it down and really have your team accountable and to dial into their leads. So I think a sales organization has the tendency to go for low hanging fruit.
Of course.
And right. Why would you do anything otherwise? Mm-hmm. So follow up sucks, right? Yeah. But the fortune really is in the follow up, not to sound cliche. I mean, you know, you're a sales trainer. I mean, you know, what's the average touches? 6 to 8, right?
I think if you want to get a deal closed, it's probably like at least 12.
Yeah, exactly. And the average person touches it, what, 2 to 3 times?
I don't think it's 2.
Exactly. So
I think it's 1.5.
Exactly. So imagine that, right? I mean, that's a huge problem, but it's also a huge opportunity.
Yeah.
So if you view it that way, and you can train your sales team to do that, mm-hmm. and you have systems, auto follow-ups. I mean, there's a lot of things we can talk about, but you're already going to be ahead of the game.
Yeah.
And for a volume business like mine that did over 7 million to find another 2+, and that was when I stopped looking because I was just getting depressed. Imagine that. I could have been an 8-figure business, is what I just told you.
Yeah.
And that was just not by doing more, not by doing extra, not by marketing more, not by hiring more. It was just following up more and having my team dig deeper. You know, so that's one of the major things that it was a pain point, but it was huge for me to rebuild the team back up.
Yeah. So you had the patience to actually go through and dive through all of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And I came home and my girlfriend was there and I was super pissed. And I remember she's like, oh, what's wrong? And I just lost it. I was like venting about it.
So I had an incident last year where I was going through this and auditing and finding things out. And I saw like, oh, just these three, just these three deals alone was like 90K in lost revenue. Right. And I just left home. I went home early that day. Right. So I normally stay here 5, 6 o'clock, whatever. I remember leaving early, getting home, sitting down, talking to the wife. It's like, how was your day? I was like, you know,
not so good.
Not so great. And I just looked at her. I was like, hey, you know, are you okay if I just like go to the casino right now? Right. It's like, why? It's like, feeling a little bit edgy right now, and I just don't want to be, I just don't want to say anything stupid at home. Just laugh. Just went to the casino, you know, just got all the anxiety out there. So going back to your situation here, right? So you went through and you reviewed the notes, reviewed the pipeline, the CRM and all that, which is amazing. One of the things that not a lot of people talk about are the difficult conversations that need to be had, right? Because you need to recalibrate your sales team and you need to let some people go.
Yep.
So talk to me about those two things.
Yeah, so I'm a data guy. You know, Mark Evans always says data, not drama. I really believe that. I think when you blur the lines of emotion, now you're making decisions based on emotion. So one thing I wanted to do was firstly make sure that I had the data to back what the hell I was going to do. So once the data was there, first of all, I have, as a leader, you have to take accountability, your own self. So I admitted and I told my girlfriend and she was like, why are you upset at yourself? I'm like, because I'm the guy at the top of the totem pole.
You allowed it to happen.
Yeah, I allowed it to happen. And that's one thing that if you're a leader, you have to start there. But I started looking through the numbers and then I combed through because everything was tagged in my Salesforce. And it was very easy to pick out, okay, this was the rep, this was the person, this is what happened, where were the notes, where was it? Because I wanted to make sure that I didn't like go at somebody and fire them, given that maybe that wasn't the scenario that happened, right?
Yeah.
So I had the full story. I made it very simple. Again, I'm a numbers guy. So yes, I have emotions and all that, and I care about my team, but I looked at where the bottom averages were, who dropped the ball the most. I had some conversations. I did do some layoffs right away because it was so blatant, where it was clear, okay, this person literally doesn't give a shit, and they're... After follow-up one, it's like, gets kicked out. And okay, cool. Now the market's not there anymore. So this person's not going to be a good fit. And then I just started backtracking. And I started noticing conversations come from that. You know, hey, if we would have had this, or hey, we could have done that, right? But it was, I allowed the organization to get complacent,
right,
is the long of it. So that's kind of how I went through it. And I started, you know, laying people off. And then I started to really tighten up the follow-up process. And then the first thing I did was, all right, well, this was the last 12 months. Let's look at what we've canceled in the last 90 days and let's see if we could do a rescue mission there because this is going to happen. And one thing I found was the average deal had closed from a cancellation on our end in 4.3 months. It was almost to a science out of 100 deals. So I had 100 deal sample size. So I'd say that that's pretty good.
Yeah.
So it was 4.3 months almost to the day where 80% of these things converted. And it was either a cash sale or a direct buy from a rehabber or a sale on the MLS, which was a cash sale. So I kind of worked backwards. We were able to save some more deals and all that. And again, it was just going through the process. I was waiting, you know, as we all were with the Fed, every decision. And I was like, all right, well, we're going to have to cut more. Okay, well, what's going on? You know, and in South Florida, we have a lot of cash. We have a lot of money down in South Florida. But I started seeing the big boys that are the serious investors pull back. And when I started seeing that, you know, we were already doing novations, which Brewer, shout out to Brewer, because he's a genius with novations. So we really started to hammer down on novations and sub twos, which I had done a little bit in my career. I've probably done like 20 of them. Not, I wouldn't consider myself an expert or anything like that, but I started to look at opportunities differently.
Yeah. So let's talk about, you know, getting those sales guys on board. Cause now you're like, hey, for this whole time, follow up however you want. So now it's like, hey, we got to make sure we're consistent. We're in the notes, we're in the CRM, and we're consistent.
Yeah.
How was that journey getting your salespeople on board with that? Because salespeople don't like that.
No, they don't.
So how was that?
They don't. So here's the funny thing about salespeople. They're kind of mavericks in you know, as we know. The best ones are mavericks,
right,
in my experience. I don't know about yours, but that also means that they're free spirits. So it's kind of tough. And, you know, again, it's the burden's on me. Because now I have to tell them, hey, everything we've been doing for the last 2-3 years, which has worked great, wasn't because you're great or we're great. It was because the market was so great. Mm-hmm. So now we have to backtrack. So the short answer is some people fell off right away.
Yeah.
Some people were like, F this. I'm not doing this.
Right.
I don't want to be told what to do. You know, this is BS. Look at all the money I've made you, right? Those conversations.
Yeah.
So that was an easy conversation for me where I'm like, well, there's a door. This isn't the organization for you.
Yeah.
And then the other people, it was a slow process to get them into it because it's tough, man. They're so used to feed me leads, 200 new leads a week in my organization. Yeah. In a week. I mean, it was spending a lot.
Yeah.
You know, on average, some weeks would be 160, but that's still a lot, right? I had 4 or 5 salespeople at the time. And now they're going down to, hey, there's 60, 70 leads a week.
Mm-hmm.
And now you got to go deeper in your pipeline.
Yeah.
So now they get antsy and they're pissed. And they're looking at me like, why am I not getting new leads? I'm having the same conversation with the same person.
Right.
And I'm like, yeah, but you don't understand. The data says that in 4.5 months, this shit's going to convert. So I need you to stick with them.
Right.
So it's a give and take. It's a give and take.
Well, so this is something that Ren and I, you know, we talk about with sales leadership. It's something we coach all our mentees on in this particular aspect. But, you know, managing salespeople is very special. thing, right?
Tell me about it.
Right? And you know, I try to explain this to other people, right? Like if you're managing like administrative people, right? General employees, this and that, like it requires some humility, it requires empathy, it requires, you know, thoughtfulness and all these other things. And then you manage salespeople. It's like a special flavor, right? You ever watch like that Stephen He video? He talks about, you know, emotional damage, right? Like there's like easy, medium, hard, and then Asian, right? And what I try to get people to understand when you're managing salespeople is like you're managing a person who's got an ego, not a big ego necessarily, but like an ego, like they're a little more confident, and this is the right way, regardless of whether it's true or not.
Sure.
Like they're more confident,
yeah,
right? They tend to be more independent, right? And ultimately, like you and me, they have the mindset that rules don't apply to me.
Yeah, which is tough.
So you got to manage people with these three things going on at all times. So there's another level of difficulty.
And it's also what, you know, to chime in here, it's also what makes good, great salespeople.
What makes them great salespeople?
Great.
Why they're so hard to manage.
Exactly. But it's a catch-22 for the business operator or owner because I'm telling you that rules don't really apply to me and I'm this and I'm that, but they apply to you. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's where the dichotomy kind of comes into play.
And you got to be more accountable in order to enforce those rules.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So you're talking about going 120K a month, 40K a month.
Mm-hmm.
What was 120K a month going towards?
Mostly direct mail. So I came back to direct mail. Mm-hmm. Direct mail has been a constant for me. Once I started to actually make money and I started to understand it, we started building out lists and all that. I think at our peak, we were mailing out close to 200,000 pieces a month.
Okay. But I mean, was 120K like all direct mail?
No. Mostly direct mail. We had, I want to say at the height, 12 cold callers.
Mm-hmm.
Texting was like 7,500 messages a day. Some PPC was sprinkled into there. Not much. I'll be the first to admit I dove into PPC. Maybe I had the wrong people. I tried 3 different services. In South Florida, it can get very expensive to do PPC.
Mm-hmm.
And with PPC, if you're not on it in 5 minutes, gone.
Oh yeah, if you're not gonna get on in 5 minutes, don't even do it.
Yeah, and you know, the cost per lead in South Florida sometimes can be $500 a lead,
mm-hmm.
maybe even $1,000, depending on the click word.
Right.
And Homevestors dominates that a lot in South Florida. So I tried the whole little approach of piggybacking off of Homevestors and copying all their stuff. And if anybody from Homevestors is listening to me, oops. but yeah,
I got a cease and desist from Homevestors.
What's that?
Because I copied it. I got a cease and desist from them.
Oh yeah,
it was a very nice letter. So. We changed a few things and we fixed that problem.
Good for them.
All right. So 120K a month was mostly direct mail.
Yeah.
And then sprinkled PPC and some cold calling.
Yep.
And texting.
And data. I mean, that was our burn rate like through the whole month. There was some salaries in there. That's not all marketing, but yeah.
Okay. So then 40K.
Mm-hmm.
What are you spending 40K on now?
So it's light direct mail, cold calling, and texting.
Okay.
I brought it honestly back to the basics. And it's a lot of my money now is being invested into remarketing, into what I have a CRM that has about 16,000 leads in it all time. So I figured the best approach would be, why don't we just start with the damn CRM that we already paid for?
Yeah.
So that was doing like once overs again and again. So I'm really trying to have the cream rise from the top in the CRM. And then it's getting, you know, the new leads in.
Yeah. And then you were talking about Novations and Brewer Method, right? So obviously you're in Brewer Method.
Yep.
So talk to me about how Brewer Method impacted your business.
So the first time I sat with Brewer, we were already doing, I think we were doing like 4 mil a year. Mm-hmm. Never done an Novation in my life. To the point where Brewer brought it up to me, mm-hmm. and I swear to God, my first thought in my head was, this guy. I'm like, who's this guy? Novation. I was like, I don't need Novations. I'm doing 400K a month. What are you talking about? Yeah. Which was stupid, by the way, kids. So with that being said, once I learned Novations and I saw it, a lot of my dead leads and a lot of the leads that were, I call them tweener deals, mm-hmm. but where they're not wholesalable, but you can't really close on them because it's not a wholesale, it's not enough margin. Mm-hmm. But you got just enough if you can work a Novation mm-hmm. where a dead lead can turn into 20K.
Yeah.
I don't give a shit. If it's 15K, which our average deal at the time was 35K. Mm-hmm. So, you know, face value, I was like, what a waste, right? But when you inverse it, it's like, but it's not a waste because it literally is a dud right now.
Well, it's zero.
It's zero. And by the way, it's negative because you paid for it.
Yeah.
You paid for the lead. You paid for the time. You paid for your employees, et cetera, et cetera. So you might as well turn it into something. Mm-hmm. So we started to do Novations and we pretty much added it to all of our language on our contracts. Mm-hmm. Where I wanted to have that exit possible.
Yeah, maximum flexibility.
Correct. Exactly.
Yeah. So I actually was on the phone with someone else in Supergroup actually earlier today.
Okay.
And he's like, he just signed up for Brewer Method.
Okay.
Right. I think he said he signed up for yesterday. And he's like, Steve, I'm looking at this. I'm going through the modules. There's literally 1,000 leads in my CRM right now that qualify for this. Like,
yeah,
I know.
I know. Dude, if you're smaller, you might not see it as that big, but an organization like mine, where I looked at it, I was like, holy shit, this is 7 figures.
Yeah.
I mean, right there.
Right.
And it's really, there's no extra remarketing or buying a list or, you know, you don't have to put them through the sales process again. No. It's just framing.
You already spent the money.
Correct.
They're in your CRM.
Mm-hmm.
And they've told you what they want.
100%. And you can, and here's the beauty, you can give them what they want.
Just give them what they want.
Exactly. You just have to frame it differently.
Yep. Exactly right. So you say you also run your business in 2 languages.
Yes.
What is that about?
I just wanted to make it extra hard. No. Yeah. So I obviously my first language is Spanish. I'm in South Florida. It's no secret. Mm-hmm. I would probably say 35-40% of my business, the sellers are Spanish speaking only. So you're dead in the water mm-hmm. if you can only speak English, right?
Yeah.
So I run it in 2 languages because we deal with a lot of sellers that only speak Spanish.
Yeah.
It's tougher. It's a different approach.
In what ways is it tougher?
So I was telling one of your crew members here that he asked me the same thing. It's more of a trust barrier mm-hmm. and Hispanic people tend to be more emotional. We like to have more rapport. Historically speaking, we're always kind of looking at someone like they're trying to pull one on me. Like a fast one, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you have to kind of get through that. And it's obviously the language is the first thing. If you're a native Spanish speaker and you don't speak English and I'm speaking to you now in Spanish and I'm fluent in it, I don't sound bad, your guard is already going to be dropped significantly because now it's like, all right, one of my people, mm-hmm. you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So from there you can build rapport. They're a little bit more rigid, Spanish speaking sellers.
Yeah.
They're like, this is how it is. This is how it's going. You know, mm-hmm. so that's its own little, you know, they're not as flexible per se. So, you know, little nuances like that. But culturally for me, I grew up, you know, with a Cuban American household. So it's what I was brought up with anyway. So
yeah,
easy.
And then recently you joined Collective Genius as well.
I think it's close to a year now.
Close to a year now?
Yeah.
So talk to me about like, because, you know, we're in Supergroup.
Yeah.
We're in Collective Genius. Talk to me about what, in Supergroup, you got all the KPIs, processes, procedures, actually running a business.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're also in Collective Genius. Talk to me about why a second mastermind and why are you in a mastermind?
So I'm in 4 now.
4.
Yeah, so I'm in 4. Look, the last question that you asked is the easiest one. Why am I in a mastermind? Mm. A mastermind changed my life years ago. So I got into Supergroup by the grace of God. I don't know how.
Yeah, I would have vetoed that. I mean.
Well, you weren't in there. I tried vetoing you when you came in. But anyway, but who's this Tran guy? But, you know, at the time when I got into Supergroup, I realized my first meeting, like a lot of things clicked for me.
Yeah.
So the mastermind's a simple one because I went through it verbatim what happened, and it skyrocketed my business. So CG, your other question was why CG?
Why are you in Collective Genius?
Yeah, so CG was always like the Rolls Royce of masterminds in my eyes. And, you know, I'd always heard everybody talk about it. It's in Tampa. So it's very convenient for me.
Yeah.
It's about a 3.5 hour drive. And I was shocked because I was like, damn, there's a lot of guys out here that live 3.5 hours away from me. That's pretty dope. Kind of like you guys over here in Phoenix.
Yeah.
There's like 47,000 gurus out here. And everybody does real estate out here.
Yeah.
So I don't know how much real estate you guys have to buy here, but it must be
a lot.
Yeah, it must be a lot.
A lot.
Maricopa's busy.
I mean, we look at, I was told, someone came on the show, they're like, yeah, you know, like Phoenix has become the guru capital of the world.
Like the Mecca.
All right. It's Mecca. But it was Tampa.
Yeah.
It was Tampa.
Yeah.
Right.
Matt Andrews is a great friend of mine. Yeah. And I was talking to him because he's been doing this since like 98.
Yeah.
And he was like, dude, this place used to be like it. Mm-hmm. Phoenix wasn't the thing.
Yeah.
It used to be Tampa. I'm like, well, what'd you guys do? what happened? I'm like, why did everybody go to Phoenix?
I think Sean Terry put us on the map.
Yeah.
And I think Matt Andrews, right? I think for being since 98, he looks really good.
Yeah.
Right.
I call him old all the time, but I just like to mess up. He's in town. He's in town now.
Is he in town right
now? Yeah, he was in Investor Fuel.
Oh, gotcha. Gotcha. Yeah. So yeah, that's the third mastermind that we're in together.
Yes.
Family mastermind.
All right. Oh, you're in that too?
I'm in that too.
You're kidding.
I'm just kind of quiet.
You're the guy that tags me with everyone in every video, at everyone.
I mean, does that really matter?
Yeah, you get me to look at every video for that reason.
Are we talking about this right now?
Yeah,
that's fine. Actually, you know what? I've actually been meaning to record material about this, but let me touch on that right now.
Yeah.
Because people watching this right now might be pissed at me because I always do it, right? So, like, as a marketer, right, as a person that's trying to help people, am I better off not tagging at everyone or better off tagging at everyone?
Better off.
And I totally understand the people that get frustrated with me tagging at everyone. I totally understand why you're frustrated,
I'm
annoyed, right? You are one of them, right?
Yeah.
But the reality is, if I am on a mission to create 100 millionaires, is it better to tag at everyone and get this message to as many people as possible? Or am I better off not tagging people?
Yeah.
If my purpose is to create 100 millionaires, then I would argue it is my responsibility.
Agreed.
To tag out everyone.
I agree.
I do feel bad that people get upset about it. But the engagement that we get from it, not the engagement as far as like likes and follows and this and that, but the people that are getting value from it, right? Because like we have people responding to these videos that we tag out everyone and they're asking questions and they're getting value.
Yeah.
So then how can I, as a person that wants to help people,
I agree,
not tag out everyone?
You would make a perfect segue into my next point, which is why I got into education.
Yeah.
For 6.5 years, I didn't want anything to do with it. Mm-hmm. I was the guy behind the scenes who built a crazy, awesome organization, in my opinion. But I was like, nah, I'm not going to teach people. Nah, I'm not going to be on Instagram or social media or whatever.
Yeah.
But I had a conversation with a friend, and he's like, dude, you have done some pretty cool shit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I know your story personally. I know who you are personally. And you are doing a disservice, especially in South Florida, where we're from, that you're not teaching people this.
Yeah.
And you're not, the fact that nobody knows you, but there's so many people that buy from you at one form or another, but they don't know you. There's no face to it. It's sad because there's a lot of people out there that might be inspired or might learn something from you, and they can change the trajectory of their life the same way that you did from a Sean Terry podcast.
Right.
So that's kind of why it clicked for me. It's doubly important because I am bilingual, so for me, I'm teaching in English and in Spanish, so it's a rarer bird, so I'm excited to kind of empower Latinos and all that in that regard, because I think it's such an underserved community in our space.
Who pulled you out of your shell?
There's a bunch of people that pulled me out of my shell, but Max Maxwell is probably, I got to hand it to him, because 3.5 years ago, he told me that. Once again, I kind of blew it off because I was focused. It wasn't, to be clear, it wasn't like I blew it off because I didn't believe in it. Mm-hmm. I was focused on building my business.
Right.
And the fallacy in the story I told myself was, well, I can't do both, you know? Mm-hmm. And, if I'm not focused on my business, then how can I teach people?
Mm-hmm.
And what I should have done, again, could have, should have, would have, but what I should have done was do both earlier rather than later. But I'm here now and I'm better for it because I've been through so much.
So to go full circle,
yes.
How did you connect with Max Maxwell?
Through Instagram.
Was there Instagram?
Yeah.
Okay. But you got to connect with him through Supergroup.
So no, so this
no.
This is the actual story. This is how it happened. This is on air. So probably 4 years ago now at this point, Max makes a post. At the time, he had like 6,500 followers. Imagine that. He's like at 400,000 now. So
and nobody with the 6,500 followers.
Yeah, like it, whatever. But
compared
at the time,
compared to who he is now?
At the time, I had like 3 followers. One of them was my mom. So, you know, it was a lot to me at the time. So I saw him post a video, him driving around for dollars with Land Glide. And he made a post, and I saw the Land Glide for the first time. I was like, holy shit, this is incredible. And I DM'd him, and I was like, hey, dude, what is that? And he's like, oh, it's this app called Land Glide, whatever. And we started talking via DM, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. This led to months. And then we became friends, and we started having phone calls or whatever. It was like our journey, wholesaling, whatever. And one day I was like, hey, man, it's my birthday. This is like a year down the line. I was like, hey, it's my birthday. You should come down to South Florida. He's like, you know what? I will come down to South Florida. We've never met. Comes down, family dinner. He shows up, and we meet for the first time. Super cool. We became good friends. He flies back. He does his first We Live event. He calls me. He's like, hey, come to Charlotte in a few weeks. You're going to speak at We Live. And I was like, I've never spoken in front of anybody in my life. This is, I don't even know what the hell I'm going to speak about.
Right.
And he's like, God, don't worry about it. Just talk about your business and how you scaled so far. Like, all right, great. Granted, this is 2018. So I fly out there, and the person ahead of me who speaks is Scott Utz. And he was well-polished. He had spoken in front of a lot of people. He was running like a $5 million a year business at the time. So I shit my pants, and I'm like, God, I got to follow up with this guy. So I go up. I probably bombed the shit out of it at the time. And we go to dinner that night, and who sits next to me? It's Utz. And him and I start drinking. We start whatever talking, and he's like, "Hey, man, we have this group called Supergroup, and we just let go of a guy that was in your Miami market.
Yeah.
So there's an opening, and I'm gonna vote you in. And honestly, bro, I don't know what the hell he was talking about. I had no idea what a mastermind was. So I was like, all right, cool, sounds great. Yeah. Like I don't know what he was talking about. And next thing you know, Max is like, hey, you're in. I'm like, great, I'm in. And I got back, and then I realized, I was like, oh, shit, I'm into this super group. And that's how it happened.
But gotcha.
That's full circle right
there. Gotcha. And then, you know, you were talking about, like, how, you know, Max pulled you know, out of your shell.
Yeah.
You know, one thing, you know, going back to the At Everyone thing, like, I actually had someone pull me aside at an event. And he's like, I had no idea you offered coaching. It's like, yeah, you know, I just don't like promoting my own stuff. Like, it just feels weird. Promoting my
Isn't
own
that
stuff.
Kind of ironic?
Right. He's like, I wish you would have been more loud about it because I just spent money on this other guy that didn't help me at all. And I was like, oh.
I can't tell you how many times now that I'm doing coaching and mentorship, how many people come to me and they say the same exact thing. They're like, dude, I just dropped 12K. I just dropped 15K. And I really didn't feel like I learned much.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wow. Like that's tough. You know?
Right. So then like me being quiet is not serving people.
Correct.
And you know, it may not appear, you know, for people watching. It may be obvious, may not be obvious, but I actually don't like putting myself out there.
That's a lie. He loves to put himself out there.
No, I don't.
He can't get enough.
But I do it to help, right?
Yeah.
And so, but yeah, when the guy said that, I was like, oh, now I feel like, now I feel really bad about myself.
Yeah.
All right. So I want to get to the audience's questions.
Yeah.
We got a whole bunch of people here. So before we get into the questions, we're going to do a real quick commercial.
These 8 steps are why I was able to build a sales force that produced over $20 million annually in wholesale profits. If you take and embrace these same steps, I know for a fact it's going to work in your organization too. Now, we only have 30 seats available in this classroom. I can't work with everybody. This is super personalized and super custom to your organization. I will personally work with each and every one of you to craft the language, the culture, the KPIs, the 15th and 30-day protocols, and help you go home with a toolbox for leadership that is going to drive results. I hope that you can take advantage of this opportunity. During this 2-day workshop, I'm going to be going over these 8 steps and so much more that I didn't even have time to mention in this video. I'm going to personally sit down with you on a one-on-one basis and make sure that you have the tools that are going to get you success. This sales leadership program has a money-back guarantee. If you don't see improvement in your revenue numbers, improvement in culture, improvement in accountability, we personally guarantee to refund the full amount of your payment.
All right, so before we even get to all the questions, Corey, Thank you for the donation. I appreciate that. When are you going to have Roughneck to Real Estate back on, man? I love Corey. Do you know Corey?
Corey who?
Corey Thompson.
I've met him before, yeah.
Yeah, Roughneck to Real Estate. Yeah, I love Corey because he's like, I can't go out there and blast people. I can't. Corey can. So I love Corey. So I'll get back to you on that. So open letter marketing. Will has put up massive numbers with our mailers. He's right through. He's right, though. It's a long game. So shout out. Thank you, open letter marketing. And you want to talk about who that is?
Yeah. So open letter marketing, Justin runs it. Mm-hmm. So I used to mail with another mail house. Mm-hmm. And then I don't really remember how I got connected, probably through a mastermind or something. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I've been using Open Letter now for over 3 years, I think.
Yeah. Is that Involo? That's the...
Yeah, right, correct.
So, yeah. So
and he developed that after the fact, yeah.
Yeah, so we partnered up with them.
Cool.
So if you guys haven't seen stuff that we're doing with Involo, definitely check that out.
Yeah. And they're actually... Sorry, but they're a great mail house because I've done so much mail in my career, and I've seen it done badly on a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. They actually... really mail what they say they're going to mail, mm-hmm. and they actually get your return mail and they scrub it and they do all these things.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like it's a hot issue, but yeah. An even bigger testament, right? Even a bigger testimonial importance. So open letter marketing. So on YouTube, Michael Lopez, we scale and got burned. What would you do if you had to start from the ground up again? So it's February 2023 and you're starting from zero.
Uh-huh.
What are you doing to build your business?
Do I have money this time around or is it from scratch?
Let's just say you lost everything in 2022, right? You're at zero.
Easy. So I would go pull as much of a list as I could buy, mm-hmm. of the highest motivated sellers. I would hop on a dialer day in, day out, and I would text in between, and mm-hmm. I would just wholesale the shit till I had $1 million.
Yeah.
And then, but in the process, one thing I would do much sooner rather than I did the last go around, I would hire yourself, people in masterminds and professionals, Harper, Dave Richter, et cetera, mm-hmm. All of that. And I would incorporate experts much faster.
Yeah.
And one thing I did do, though, the last go around, was seek a mentor very fast. Mm-hmm. I knew for whatever reason, there were people that had been where I wanted to go, and I was willing to cut equity and or put money in their pocket, mm-hmm. for valuing their time.
Well, you did that with your first five deals.
Correct.
Right.
And that's how I approach things. That's why, for anybody listening, please take this as the best piece of advice I can give on this podcast. Do not approach someone, and I know why people do it. I get it. I used to do it too. But do not approach somebody and say, can I pick your brain? You should pick your nose. Don't pick my brain.
Yeah.
Okay? You should approach people, mentors, et cetera, people that you perceive to have value for you. You should approach them with value.
Right.
Because they're getting bombarded all the time. Mm-hmm. So one way to do that, hey, I will split my first five deals with you 50-50, mm-hmm. if you teach me what you know. Right. That is a totally different conversation. If somebody approaches me like that, which they do now, mm-hmm. I am much more inclined to
more
listen
receptive.
And learn, yeah. and teach.
Yeah.
Not, hey, man, can I take you out to coffee for 15 minutes and learn everything I can about real estate? I'm like, that's such an insult, you mm-hmm. know? And what am I going to teach you in 15 minutes?
Yeah.
Really?
Well, I mean, what people fail to recognize, right? If we have an organization, let's just say hypothetically, we're only making $100,000 a year.
Yeah.
Right? That's $50 an hour. Mm-hmm. Right? For me to take 15 minutes to go have coffee with you, it costs me $12.50.
Yeah.
Like, it literally costs me money to go. That's assuming I have $100,000 in your business.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah.
Odds are the mentor you're talking to is making more than $100,000 a year.
Correct.
Right? Okay. So there's a few things here. Let's break it down real quick. So you would call.
Yes.
You would cold call and you would text. Mm-hmm. What are you using the cold call?
Well, back in the day, I used to use Mojo Dialer.
Mm-hmm. Today?
Today, I don't know that I would use Mojo. I haven't used the dialer because we've used the calling service mm-hmm. for many years. But I've heard, what's the name of that dialer? I can't think of the name right now. But okay.
So for the record.
Multi-line dialers.
We use Call Tools 2.0. Okay.
Call Tools. That's the one.
So yes. How would you be texting?
Launch Control.
Launch Control for texting.
Yeah.
Who would you be calling and texting? What list would you pull?
Yeah, so it's an easy one. I'm in Florida, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of absentee landlords. So absentee landlord with some equity mm-hmm. out of state would probably be where I'd start. And tax delinquent, which is how I made millions from starting off anyway. Mm-hmm. I got taught that by a mentor. And then pre-foreclosure. Pre-foreclosure right now in today's market is a great list.
Yeah.
Because they're starting to feel the fire now. Mm-hmm. Forbearance is over.
Yeah.
So they've been sitting on the sidelines for a long time. Right. And I've picked off a lot of good subject to deals, which we can talk about one if we have the time, mm-hmm. which I'm pretty proud of. So.
Yeah. All right. So then you said David Richter for finances.
Yeah.
Right. Getting your financial house in order, your business financial house in order.
Correct.
Gary Harper to shape your business.
To systemize it. Yep.
Right. And you said you'd hire me. So
yeah.
Instead of me promoting it, why don't you talk about why you would hire me?
Well, I mean, you're just such a great guy to talk to. You know?
Yeah.
Just the sales training. The sales training. I wish I would have rather than train them myself. Mm-hmm. But I did hire you, though.
I know you did. That's what I'm saying.
Later.
I want you to share like what how that helped you. Like how did hiring me help your team?
Well, number one, it was accountability. Mm-hmm. So it was coming from a different party, not me, mm-hmm. the business operator and the owner who you have to see every day.
Mm-hmm.
So it was coming from an authority. So that's mm-hmm. number one. Number two, you have really good stuff. It actually works. Number three, it's accountability.
Mm-hmm.
So your weekly calls and all of that mm-hmm. keep my sales team accountable. Mm-hmm. And they know where to show up. I it takes the guesswork. Look, being an operator, being an owner, already has a million things a day that I have to do.
Ton of obligations.
Yes. Where one less off my plate, which is the most important one in my opinion, because it's a sales organization. Mm-hmm. It's where your freaking revenue comes from.
Yeah.
That's awesome. If I can put a custodian in there that's great and is a good steward of that, that's a huge thing off your plate. And to be honest, sales is not my natural thing. I'm good at speaking to people. I've had to learn to sell and mm-hmm. to learn to be good at sales. But that's because I've had to learn. I don't think I'm a natural born salesperson.
Right. Yeah, I think you're a natural leader, natural driver.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So, all right. So then let's talk about that sub-2 deal.
Yeah.
Well, you're saying there was something you want to talk about.
It's pretty cool. So a student of mine brought this deal to me. And again, the importance of having someone in your corner that knows what they're doing, right? Mm-hmm. To maximize the deal. So long story short, ended up buying the deed, $6,000 for the deed. The ARV on the house is $900,000. All right. Now, let's stop there for a second because it seems like a huge disparity. There's a first position mortgage that I took sub to at 410. And then there was a lot of liens, violations, bullshit on the property. So probably the all-in figure is like 480 with everything I got into it. The ARV is 900.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm going to do a cash out refi and I'm going to keep this property and I'm going to renovate it, et cetera, and keep it as a rental. And a cash out refi, number one, is tax-free. So. Mm-hmm. Who doesn't love tax-free?
Right.
Number two, it's going to pay itself off in cash flow. And number three, I started, and this is why I was proud of it, because it's for your listeners, the mindset shift of looking at things. If you expand your time horizon long enough,
mm-hmm.
you'd be impressed with the different kinds of decisions you can make.
Yeah.
Why do I say that? I could wholesale this deal today and make $140,000. No question about it.
Yeah.
I've done that enough times in my life where I'm like, okay, if I have the $140,000, it's not going to pay me ever again long term, right? It's not mm-hmm. residual. So now if I expand it out to 10-year time horizon, that deal is worth $1 million to me
mm-hmm.
over the next 10 years. I could also depreciate it. I can use it for tax savings. And the list goes on and on and on.
Right.
And over the next 10 years, I view it and I'm like, I can conservatively say, and I'm sure you would agree, I could probably cash out refi two more times mm-hmm. in the next 10 years. That's a full cycle, right? So I've done the math and I'm like, man, this deal is going to pay me out close to $900,000 over the next 10 years.
Right.
And I'm going to save a lot of money on taxes. So that's what I'm saying about extending your time horizons mm-hmm. and just delaying gratification.
Yeah. So tax-free money.
Yes.
And you're reducing your taxes.
Correct.
Right. So
that's a double whammy.
So you said it was deeded to you for $6,000.
Yeah.
What kind of deed?
It was a warranty deed.
Yeah. Warranty deed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you had a homeowner with $410,000. First mortgage, whole bunch of junk liens, and then the remaining $6,000.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious.
Yeah.
Were you able to reduce or renegotiate all these other subsequent liens?
Yeah,
afterwards?
Of course. Yeah. So I'm in the process right now with the city. Mm-hmm. I'm at the finish line, really.
Yeah.
So it was a lot of hair on this deal. It sounds so clean because it's
well, the best deals are the hairiest deals.
Correct. Now, the lady, the seller, we've helped her find a place. she was not in a good headspace. Like, you know, there was a lot of stuff that had happened to her. A roofer took off with all her money, left 3,500 loose tiles on a roof. Imagine in South Florida, which is one of the reasons why the violations came in. Mm-hmm. So hurricanes could have came in and blown those tiles and mm-hmm. hurt people at any given time. So she's living in a really, really bad, poor condition, no water, literally no electricity. So we've helped her with that. We've paid those things. We're helping relocate her. And I'm going to clear off the foreclosure so that her credit doesn't have to get dinged and yeah. she doesn't have to go to bankruptcy, et cetera.
Yeah, I think one of the cool things that, you know, people don't really talk about it, but, you know, something I learned along the way is that you can buy this deed for $6,000 and you get all these liens in between. Once you've bought the property, those liens, although they're tied to the property, they're also tied to the person. Mm-hmm. And when you come in, when Willie comes in,
yep.
it's like, hey, I'm the owner here. I see there's these liens,
yep.
but they're not my liens.
Right.
What can we do about this? They'll settle at a steep discount. So for her, it was like $80,000 worth of liens or whatever. For you, it's like $8,000 worth of liens.
Yeah, if that.
Right?
Yeah.
So just, you know, hopefully just you guys watch all the way through here. Like that alone, right, on top of him getting $900,000 in tax-free money later on,
yeah.
that you can learn. Like there's other ways to get creative on these deals.
Correct. Yeah.
All right. So next question here is the only small tours, I guess, today. I mean, Willie Numbers.
What did he say?
Who is our guest today is Willie Numbers, obviously. So David's asking.
Come on, wake up.
On IG, are you texting in Spanish?
I do text. Yeah. Some of the texts are in Spanish, but they're follow-up texts.
Yeah.
So I don't text in Spanish right off the bat because I don't know who in my list only speaks Spanish. So it'd be a little tough to do.
Sure.
But once I see that sellers respond in Spanish back, because they'll get an English message and they'll just respond back in Spanish, like, no sé qué gesto, de qué hablas, whatever. Or they'll just tell you, like, in Spanish, yes, I want to sell my house, whatever, for this, because I guess they translate it. But then it will switch to Spanish.
There you go.
Not cold marketing, though.
That makes a ton of sense.
Yeah. My cold callers, though, they're fully bilingual. Mm. So they will pivot immediately.
Gotcha. So KL Real Estate on YouTube, do you do JV deals in South Florida?
I absolutely do.
What's the best way for them to bring you a deal?
WillJV.com is one of them. My Instagram is another one. I'm very, very active on Instagram. And then WillieNumbers.com, so with a Y, mm-hmm. Is my full website. Everything's on there and you can reach me out.
WillJV.com.
Yeah.
That's a brilliant URL.
Isn't it? Thank you, man. You know, I had some static from some people. They're like, oh, I don't really know if I like it. I was like, it's WillJV. Like you WillJV,
yeah.
but WillJV.
I know.
It just makes sense.
A double entendre. That's
double entendre. Thank you, Steve.
Yeah, that is.
You're enlightened, Steve. You know that?
Thank you.
You're an enlightened man. You really are.
Yeah, I mean, I love opportunities. You know, we had max cash offers, right?
Yeah.
Like the reason why it was max cash offers was that we'll give you the max amount of cash, but my business partner at the time, his name was Max.
Yeah, he managed. Yeah, exactly. Right?
So I was like, hey, we should just call it max cash offers. So yeah,
exactly.
I don't know. Maybe I'm just silly, but I love the.
It just makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's uniform.
Or like, you know, our show is Certainty Talks, right? CertaintyTalks.com. But like, we talk about certainty, but also, you know, the show is called, like, we're talking about certainty. So like, if you have certainty, it speaks volumes,
mm-hmm.
right? But also, we're talking about certainty. So I don't know. Like I said, I might just be a total nerd. Follow up. Totally get it, but it's rough. Makes me reevaluate the group I get the notification from. If I stay after an ad, it's because the group is offering solid content. Anything else and I'm gone. Oh, so that was nice of him. YouTube, Julio says, did a deal with Will. Super cool. Very knowledgeable. So that's a nice.
Thank you.
That's a nice plug from Julio.
Thank you, Julio.
Julia on IG, when you find owners of 30 plus property rentals, what do you think the probability is they want to sell?
Well, that's a great, great, great opportunity to do a portfolio deal.
Mm-hmm.
And I would try to structure owner finance on something like that.
So let's talk about it. All right. So you got a lead.
Mm-hmm.
30 plus properties.
Yep.
Or you got a lead and you find out he or she's got 30 plus properties.
Mm-hmm.
What is your approach from when the lead comes in? Like someone on your team is like, hey, Willie, we got a deal. We got an opportunity. What is your procedure or process for that?
I'm going to take that opportunity. I'm going to
take so it myself. So Willie is going to say, hey, let me review this.
Let me review that. Okay. Let me look at it. And I'm probably going to deal with that seller myself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm definitely going to want to meet with that seller. This is not something that I'm going to take lightly or do it over the phone.
Mm-hmm.
Chances are that is a very sophisticated seller. Mm-hmm. That is an investor. But I bought my first 16 doors. So some real life feedback for her is I bought my first 16 doors from a seller who owned 450 doors that gave me owner finance at 4%.
Yeah.
So I got in the game only because I asked. Mm-hmm. So those are great deals that you can structure as a portfolio deal. Funds will buy that. You have a more sophisticated buyer, and or you can figure out ways to carve out some of the properties, keep them for yourself, sell the other ones at a profit. I mean, I can go on and on and on. It's a hell of an opportunity, assuming that the seller obviously is within the realm of reality.
Yeah. So I would say probably, Julia, reach out to Willie.
Yeah.
See, maybe you guys could work at this deal together.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially if it's in South Florida.
Yeah.
No question.
So I think one of the things that you look at, anytime someone's got a lot of properties, there's this like ideas like they're too sophisticated, they'll never work with me.
Right.
Right. Like they're such a smart investor, like they won't take me seriously.
Sure.
The reality is everyone's got problems.
Mm-hmm.
Right. If they popped up on your list, they popped on your list for a reason.
Correct.
Right. So I think that's the first thing, like get out of this mindset that they're too sophisticated for me.
Mm-hmm.
Second, my default with a portfolio is they're probably older and they're probably more interested in owner finance than a cash offer.
Yep.
Right.
They don't want to get wrecked on taxes either.
Exactly.
That's so a great conversation.
They don't want to pay taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And they enjoy the cash flow they've had this whole time. If you can give them that same cash flow, they're open to owner finance.
Correct.
Right.
And the way that I frame an owner finance conversation is so simple and it's always worked out for me, which is how would you like to be a landlord and get cash flow without being a landlord?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
That question's an opener and they're like, yeah. And I'm like, listen, how would you like to save a shit ton on taxes?
Mm-hmm.
I don't say shit, but how would you like to save a ton on taxes?
Right.
And, oh, what do you mean? Not a 1031, but if you sell to me and I'll put down a significant down payment and you hold the note, you do not get wrecked on taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine if you've owned something where I bought the real world example. Someone's owned something for 25 years. They paid, let's just say $100,000.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're selling me that something for $600,000.
Mm-hmm.
Well, their cap gains is $500,000. Okay. That's a huge tax burden.
Yeah.
Imagine if it's in the millions. Some people are going to have a seven-figure tax bill.
Mm-hmm.
Who do you know is excited about paying seven figures? No, people are going to do anything to avoid that legally, obviously.
Yeah.
And owner financing is one way. 1031 tax change is another way. Converting that seller into a lender, great way.
Mm-hmm.
What are they going to do with all that money? That's a natural conversation I'm going to have with that seller. Hey, Mr. Seller, I know you're getting $1.5 million out of this. Have you thought about what you're going to do with that money? Chances are they have not.
Yeah.
It's probably going to sit in the bank or go to some stupid wealth advisor.
Right.
Right. You can loan, you can loan me that money and I can put the money to work for you. Securitized by an asset, first position. Easy conversation.
Right.
Easy segue.
Yep. So I think that's powerful. There was someone at, within CG actually, he was talking about how he does portfolio deals. He's like, yeah, you know, we have.
Yeah. I can't remember his name. Who is it?
It was Lance.
Yeah, dude. He did a $2.5 million deal off of 40 homes.
Yeah. $2.5 million assignment fee.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and the same thing. It's like, yeah, nobody markets to me.
Yeah.
And he's like, you're kidding.
Yeah. He was the only one that was talking to the owner.
Correct. And that's another thing too. You know, I've started to focus on bigger deals, like land split deals, multi-million-dollar deals, because think about it this way. A $300,000 property, 10% rip on that is $30,000.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. $2 million property, 10% rip on that, $200,000.
Yeah.
Could be bigger.
And slightly different conversation.
Less competition.
Mm-hmm.
A lot, just by default, by what you said, which is, well, a lot of people, those people aren't going to want to deal with.
Yeah.
Well, great. That means 98% of people aren't talking to these people.
Yeah. Well, you know, I remember we had drinks with Tim Brotts one night.
Yeah.
Right? Again, going back, you know, CG, right? We're just hanging out.
Mm-hmm.
And I just asked, like, Tim, how are you doing these deals, these apartment deals? Like, how is this happening? How does it even make sense? Like, aren't they more sophisticated? You know what he said to me? Same exact thing we just said here. They've got problems too.
Yeah.
Right?
You don't think rich people get divorced? Rich people get divorced all the time. Rich people don't have bad tenants? Absolutely. Rich people don't get code violations from the city? They do.
Yeah.
And the thing is, they do have problems. And when their problems arrive, they have more zeros attached to them.
Yeah.
So just remember that.
Right.
They're much bigger problems.
Much bigger problems. And therefore, we get paid.
And also, they value their time differently.
Yeah.
Where they value, when you're making money, your decision making is much quicker.
Mm-hmm.
You're not, well, I got to think about it. Da, da, da. No, I value my time. You're telling me it's cash. It's faster. I put a premium on that.
Not just value the time, but they've got no problems with you making money.
Correct.
Because their relationship with money is different.
Correct.
Yeah.
That's a really good point.
Yeah. All right. So what does your business look like right now versus your first year in the business?
my first year in the business was a two-man band. It was like that till almost my second year in the business when we hired our first VA. Mm-hmm. My business today is 7 VAs, 6 cold callers, 3 in-house people, and myself.
Yeah.
So we used to have a lot bigger team, but we used to have a project manager we let go once we started slowing down on rehabs and all that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What freedom does real estate afford you?
The freedom of choice. And you're probably going to ask me, what do I mean?
Yeah, I was going to exactly where I was going with this.
Yeah. The choice to decide what I want to do with that specific asset at that moment.
Yeah.
For example, this sub two deal, could wholesale it, make a bunch of money, could rehab it, make more money, could keep it, cash out, refi, tax free, make money for life. Mm-hmm. That's a choice.
Yeah. Besides financial freedom, what else do you love about real estate?
That I never stop learning. And just when I think that I'm hot shit, I'm not. and there's always a level up from there. So, you know, I would venture to say that I've mastered the single family game and all that stuff. And I feel very confident in that. And there's still stuff that I'm learning day to day. But now I'm playing in the multifamily space. And it's a totally different conversation, totally different lessons. I'm playing in a different conversation now. Yeah. So there's always a level up in real estate. And the more you figure out, the coolest thing, in my opinion, about real estate is that since the dawn of time, it's been used by wealthy individuals to mitigate taxation and for perpetual growth of wealth.
Yeah.
Once you figure out that game, that's a totally different conversation.
Yeah.
And now it's like, it's literally like the game of Monopoly, where now you're playing with assets and you're like, what if I could do that? What if I could cost seg that? Well, you know, and you can do all these creative things, and I'm just scratching the surface. So it's crazy how much I can, you know, you still learn day to day.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
What is your why?
So I come from a single mom and a single grandmother. Didn't grow up with money. So my why was always to be able to help them and retire them. And, you know, I bought my mom a house in 2021. Awesome. So that was the best real estate transaction I've ever done. Mm-hmm. So for me, my why was always them, you know. Yeah. And it's just, you know, I'm getting like watery right now just talking about it. So yeah, it's always that. So anytime I've faced adversity or anything like that, and anyone listening to this right now, if your why is that big, like, it doesn't have to be your family, whatever. Mm-hmm. But if your why is that big and it's unmovable, there's nothing that'll keep you down for more than, you know, just a temporary time.
Yeah. Tell me about the house you bought your mom.
I bought my mom a house in Boca, East Boca. It's nice. And I bought the house like right after COVID. So I picked it up for like 500 grand. It's probably worth like 950 today. Mm-hmm. So kudos to my mom. She's got a bunch of equity in it. But yeah, it was I had reached a certain accolade and a certain amount of success financially. Mm-hmm. And my birthday was coming up, funny enough. And I was kind of thinking I want to get myself something like a gift, you know? Mm-hmm. And I thought about it and I thought about it and I thought about it. And then it just hit me. I was like, you know what? I have all this nice shit and this and that. My mom is also a flipper, by the way. So I taught her how to fix and flip and she's crushing it. She does like 20 homes a year by herself.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. My girlfriend actually works with her and they do projects together. So it's an all family affair. Mm-hmm. So anyway, and I spoke to a buddy of mine and I was like, you know what, man? I think I'm going to buy my mom a house. 'Cause that's like the greatest gift I can give myself. Mm-hmm. So I took her out to lunch and I thought I was just going to tell her, hey, I'm buying you a house. And it was just going to go over no problem. So an hour of crying later at the lunch, it looked like I had fought with her or something. And she just broke down, was yelling and everything. And oh my God, it was like a disaster. And it was at a public place. I'm like, oh my God, this is so embarrassing. It's just not how I planned this. But so I bought her the house and the closing and, you know, renovated it. And she lives in it with my grandmother and they love it. So
why was she yelling at you?
Oh, she was just like yelling because she was so happy. Like she was literally, she's Cuban, man. She's just like, she's just yelling like for anything and just crying and no, you're not going to do that. And like all these things came out. I was like, listen, it's happening. So you're not going to take this away from me. I was like, you did everything for me.
Yeah.
Don't take this from me. Yeah. And I started crying and it was not how I planned it. I thought it was just going to be like, hey, by the way, I'm buying your house. She's like, all right, thanks. And then we were just going to go home. Yeah. And that's not how it worked out. So
this was, you told her before you closed?
Yeah, so I told her, you know, this is what I want to do. Mm-hmm. pick a house. Like, you know, I wasn't going to buy it for her and all that. Yeah. So then that was a process.
So what was it like when you handed her the keys?
It was, dude, man, it's surreal. Every time I go visit her, it's still, it's like, it gives me such peace of mind. No matter what turmoil or whatever, like ups and downs in business or whatever, when I go to sleep at night, at least I know there's something there that, and she's a stud. She makes her own money. Mm-hmm. Like she does well, but it's something that, at least a little bit of something that I know no one could take away from her, mm-hmm. And my grandmother, and they're comfortable, and it's a really nice house with a pool, and we can go over there, and it's a peace of mind that nothing, you know, can replace.
Yeah, well, I mean, I love this story because like we all talk about like, you know, what's your why, you know, mm-hmm. this and that, and like the idea like it. There's a lot of adversity in building a business. There's a lot of adversity in sales, and if you're clear on your purpose, then you can get through that adversity,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's cool to see, like, not only did you have your purpose, but you fulfilled it.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah. There's a lot of things I haven't fulfilled yet.
But on that one, you were clear.
But on that one, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was, there's nothing, like, if the last 6 years were worth nothing, if it was just worth that, then that's everything.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
What's your biggest struggle today?
Biggest struggle today? I wish I had 28 hours in a day. I really do.
You just need some time management.
Yeah, right. Man, my biggest struggle today, honestly, man, I feel like I had a rough last year and a half. So many things were being thrown at me, the economy, you know, bad partnerships, whatever, where I feel more clear than anything. So I actually feel like I don't have a huge struggle right now. Mm-hmm. It's just, I guess the struggle would be to make sure that I stay on track. And that I stay as focused and committed and as hungry, even when you get higher up.
Yeah. And how are you resolving that? How are you ensuring that?
So my network is big. So accountability, you know, through the masterminds and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Making sure that, you know, one thing that I would tell anybody here, if you're in a committed relationship or anything like that, make sure that your spouse or your significant other or whatever buys into the dream too. It's very difficult to go on a path with someone else and they don't fully understand the path that you're on or they don't agree with it. So make sure that you guys have some pretty clear-cut goals and you're running in the same direction. Doesn't mean that you have to be the same, but that you're both going to support each other.
Yep. How will you know when you're successful?
How will I know?
Mm-hmm.
I'll let you know when I get there.
How are you measuring it?
Fulfillment now. Mm-hmm. It's not a monetary thing for me anymore. Once I started educating people and seeing, you know, I started hosting live events in South Florida.
Yeah.
The amount, I know it's going to sound super corny, but the amount of fulfillment that I get from watching somebody come to me and hit their first 20, 30K deal and that light bulb goes off.
Yeah.
You know, I could go do a 200K deal and I'd be excited for like a day.
It's and that's that.
But it's not the same as you know.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, for me, I got in the, like a lot of people, we get into business for money.
Yeah, no shit.
We get into business for money, but the money doesn't really drive you after a while, right?
No.
But when you see other people winning because you helped them, like that can fuel you forever. The dopamine you get from that far exceeds any dollar figure.
Yeah, and I'll say this, just kind of couple what you said. I'm more in a race, and this is just, maybe somebody on this thing needs to hear it because I know I wish I would have heard it before. But I'm more in a race today with myself and I've kind of accepted the fact that, hey, I'm running my own race.
Yeah.
I think comparison is the mother of all suffering. And I think it's very easy in today's society to see what somebody's doing or to see me up here on an interview. It's like, oh, I wish I had what he had or I wish I was there. But you don't really know the full backdrop behind it. You have to run your own race. Yeah. And as long as you see that and you live that, dude, you will make it so much further, so much faster. And I wish I would have seen that earlier.
Yeah. I mean, I think so wise. You know, we talk a lot about uncertainty talks is like, you know, play your game.
Yeah.
And nobody wins a race they don't want to be in.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah.
So I think that's powerful.
And life is an infinite game. You know, I used to think it's so crazy. I used to think if I could make 200 grand a year, then all my problems would be solved. And I can tell you from personal experience, far exceeding that goal, it just created a whole other set of problems. Now, I wouldn't trade them, but Yeah. It's not, it never stops. It's always something else.
Yeah. What would be the fun if it did stop?
Exactly. No, we all be bored.
You're wired to solve problems.
Correct. Exactly right.
What is your superpower?
What is my superpower? Consistency and resiliency.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Talk to me about that. How are you consistent?
When I latch on to something, I latch on. So consider it done.
Yeah.
So when I got into education and all that, it was just, that was it. It was dialed in for me. And I said to myself, I was like, I'm going to be the number one educator in this space in English and Spanish. Mm-hmm. That's a goal. That's an affirmation I say every day. And so it shall be. So
game on.
Game on. Yeah, right. Steve, I got you on the language one though. But you got Mandarin. That's that.
You know, I love that you said consistency. So I was on Rafael Cortez. I was at a studio yesterday. We recorded a podcast, you know, and we made the joke, right? Like entrepreneurs, like, you know, I will do whatever it takes except for consistency. Like, let's just, let's leave that one off the table. But everything else, I'll do anything else except for consistency.
Yeah. Consistency. Listen, man, I know it's such an unsexy word. It's not cool. It's not flashy. But dude, consistency is honestly probably the most underrated thing, because if you do anything consistently, and I'm not talking about for, you know, years and years and years, obviously you're going to change course if it's not working, but dude, 90, like, whether it's your health or meeting new people or starting a business or doing a new activity in your business, just commit for it for 90 days, a quarter. It's really not anything. But if you track those results and you consistently put up those efforts, dude, in 90 days, I guarantee you, it's going to be a totally different outlook.
Yeah.
Guaranteed.
Yeah.
And if people did more of that instead of the pizzazz and the flash, you'd get there. Mm-hmm. You'd have the pizzazz and the flash.
Yeah.
You know?
So, no, that's an absolutely great point. So, final question here is, what book have you gifted more than any other?
Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that book as well. And, you know, again, I say this from time to time, like, that's one of the two books that most successful people have.
Yeah.
Right.
That one this one I haven't really gifted, but I was about to say Get Rich or Die Trying, but that was a 50 Cent album.
I actually have that poster in my office.
No, Kiyosaki. I mean, obviously.
Yeah.
Kiyosaki's the legend.
Yeah, absolutely.
Rich Dad Poor Dad is a staple.
So I want you to think about a message you want to leave all the listeners with while I make just a couple of quick announcements.
Cool.
Guys, if you got value today, please like, subscribe, share, comment. It helps us reach more people. And we do have our leadership event coming up in just 4 weeks. Actually, I think it's 3.5 weeks. So if you're interested in coming up to our sales leadership event, text LEADERS to 33777. And be sure to tune in next week. We got Mark Delator coming out to do the show next week. All right. So last thoughts, what message would you like to leave everyone with?
That's a good question, Steve. If you're looking to get started, or you're looking to scale, regardless of where it is, I am in the space now to help and empower people to do that, particularly in South Florida. The message that I'll leave is that I've been putting together live events. Mm-hmm. I'm looking to take that all the way. It will be the premier event in South Florida within the next year or so. Quote me on that one here. And, you know, I'm looking to bring a lot of what I've seen in Phoenix to South Florida. Mm. So if you really want to work hard and you want to get to it and you want to learn this business or scale it, hit me up, contact me, and I'd be happy to help.
How can I attend one of your live events?
Just be there.
Just be there.
You mean you personally?
No, anyone, right? Like someone's listening.
I expect you there, Steve.
Of course.
You got to fly the opposite direction.
Yeah. I mean, you book a first round trip. We'll talk. So, but generally speaking, someone's listening. Yeah. How can they attend your live event in South Florida?
So I do a webinar every Tuesday at 6 p.m., which is 100% free. And then every month we're going to be doing these live events. So we always post them on Instagram, on Linktree, everything. And it's just a live event. I host them with my buddy Henry, and we're doing them in Fort Lauderdale. So eventually we'll outgrow that venue and, you know, we'll do it. But it's free to attend. Anyone can go. I'm going to start having guests come on, but it's really a live Q&A and it's a networking event as well. We can answer anything and run real deals, real time, deal with real issues from people. Again, whether you've never done a deal or you're doing couple deals a month and you want to scale to 7 figures, anything is free game there.
Awesome. Very cool. So if someone wants to get a hold of you, what's the best way to do that?
Instagram at Willie Numbers. TikTok, the same. WillieNumbers.com is the same thing. Mm-hmm. All my information is there. And WillJV.com as well.
Awesome. Thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure. Glad to have you out here.
I appreciate it.
See you guys later.
Take care.